Welcome back to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here. Well, in July of 1990, President Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, potentially the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Reports on the number of people covered by the law vary widely, from some 14 million to as many as 43 million people. And here with us this morning from his office at Syracuse University to bring us up to date on this important legislation is Dr. Peter Blank. He's a university professor of Syracuse University, and he's also the chairman of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University, which advances the civil rights of people with disabilities around the world. He is also an attorney and a psychologist. Wow. Welcome, Dr. Blank. Thanks for joining us today by phone.
My pleasure.
So tell us a bit more about this landmark legislation. How did it come into being?
Well, the ADA was passed in 1990 with very strong bipartisan support, and it really was a revolutionary piece of legislation at the time. It was the first major comprehensive anti-discrimination law on the basis of disability, which, by the way, subsequently many other countries have modeled and developed further. The law is basically... It's so large, it could be several laws unto itself. It includes employment protections for people with state and local governmental activities, protections in telecommunications and in the private sector at hotels and malls and restaurants, and was amended in 2010 and as part of the Americans with Disabilities Amended Act to actually broaden its scope to enable it to be more effectively applied to many, many people with disability.
And is there also a part of it that addresses the issue of children with special needs?
Well, there is a separate law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which, of course, addresses children with special needs and their right to a free and appropriate education in public education. But the ADA does not discriminate by age. So children with special needs, elderly, all sorts of folks are covered by the law.
So the specific goals of that whole movement really were things like accessibility, safety and transportation, the whole architecture, physical environment, and equal opportunities, as you pointed out, for both independent living, employment, education, housing, all of that.
Yes, it was the first time to bring that all together in a comprehensive anti-discrimination law that would address people over the life course. And, of course, as you say, in many, many different spheres of daily life.
So who have been most affected by this law?
So the law is not defined by diagnostic category, and many, many people with different sorts of conditions are covered. The definition of disability is on the basis of a person's interaction with society. So it's not purely a medical model. It's a functional social model as well. So, for example, it's defined as whether or not people are substantially limited in an activity that is a major life activity that they do in their everyday lives. So working, traveling, going to stores, and so forth.
Entertainment, all of those kinds of things.
Entertainment, of course. If you've gone to a movie theater or a theater, there are handicapped seating, and there's audio assistance devices and so forth. All of that is a result of the ADA.
So what is the current state of disability rights in this country?
Well, that's a very good question and an important question, and it goes to the broader focus on civil rights in this country. Of course, the disability rights movement builds on the pioneering efforts of the race and gender movements, but even today, for example, in the race area, we're having a case come up to the United States Supreme Court which questions the viability of so-called special or affirmative action opportunities that result from civil rights legislation. Now, in the disability area, much of the debate has been first over who is covered by this law, who is defined as a person with a disability, and secondly, if so, do accommodations or changes in the environment actually give people with disabilities a fair or unfair advantage? And this debate is part of the larger questioning of the civil rights movement in society that we see in many areas.
And I think also is probably historical in the sense that after a certain amount of time, I think Justice Scalia just made some kind of a comment about that maybe there is no greater need for things like affirmative action, and in this case, maybe the rights of the disabled, because it's already been integrated into our society?
Well, that's one view of the world. Fortunately, that was in the minority in a number of cases. In the disability arena, I won't speak to race and gender. They have different issues. But in the disability arena, clearly there is a lot of work to do. There are some 50 million plus people with disabilities covered by this law, as you mentioned in your opening. Many, many people face discrimination in all sorts of activities, access to health care, access to public transportation, access to emergency services. And this longstanding discrimination that has been faced is very difficult to overcome in one generation. Having said that, there have been terrific strides made. I believe the world is certainly more accessible than it was before the ADA was passed, but there's still much work to do.
So, in other words, at this point, you're feeling that you're nowhere near what the ultimate goal of the legislation was.
Well, I would say that there's still widespread discrimination. There's still high unemployment of people with disabilities due to lack of access to employment and transportation. There are still many, many small and large businesses which make it challenging for customers with disabilities to be involved with their goods and services. One area, for example, that's on the front burner now is the whole area of the internet revolution and social media and how people with disabilities can properly be included in that whole information technology revolution, whether they're deaf or blind or cognitively impaired.
Yeah, it sounds like there remain a lot of very, very significant challenges, and it seems that economics must play a role in this as well.
Yes, one of the famous disability civil rights leaders, however, a guy named Justin Dart, who was a very successful businessman himself, took the position that civil rights and economics are really two sides of the same coin. That is, inclusion of people with disabilities in society is good for the economy. And even though it's, of course, a civil right, things can be done in sensible ways that make reasonable costs and benefits that enable more people with disabilities to be paying customers, as their dollars, of course, are just as green as anybody else's.
It makes a great deal of sense, but you could well understand how organizations, especially small businesses, might find it onerous to put in potential handicapped accessibility things and things of that nature. So it's...
There's no question there's economies of scale. However, for small businesses, there are tax credits and there are economic incentives to accommodate employees with disabilities. But yes, certainly there are economic challenges. My view is that while there are costs, of course, the benefits outweigh the costs. And in fact, the empirical research that I and others have done on thousands of businesses and people with requesting accommodations have borne that out.
So what do you think have been the greatest successes to date?
Change in attitude, change in the way people with disabilities are included in society, because at the end of the day, we can put in all the ramps and we can put in all the hearing devices and so forth, but if there is still underlying attitudinal discrimination that people with disabilities are second-class citizens or really should be shunned away in institutional settings, then it's very difficult to overcome those sorts of barriers.
Is there data suggesting that there really has been a shift in attitude?
Yes, I believe so. I believe so globally as well. In early 2000, the first international treaty of the new millennium was passed, and it was on the global rights of persons with disabilities, called the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Some 150 nations signed on to it, I believe. Unfortunately, the United States, for various reasons, chose not to ratify it. The president was supportive, President Obama, and signed it and sent it to the Senate, but the Senate decided, voted not to ratify it.
Why?
Well, there are always a lot of political issues associated with that. There was a sense that the United States was already an exemplar in many of these areas, and this would crimp, perhaps, or conflict with some of the civil rights laws in the United States.
Oh, I see.
My own view was that it really is a compliment, and it was a missed opportunity because the U.S. would be part of a larger world community that respected and believed in these sorts of rights.
You know, I was going to ask you a question, and you've already answered it, and that was the notion of the global impact of this law, because my question in mind was, were we late in the game or a trendsetter? And clearly, you've just indicated that we were a major trendsetter.
Well, we were a trendsetter, and subsequent laws followed in many countries like England and Australia and Ireland and so forth. But I don't want to be too U.S.-centric. Many of those countries built on these laws, had other approaches to these laws, and took it in much more of a human rights approach rather than just a civil rights approach. And by that I mean in countries in Europe, for example, there's a greater focus on welfare reform and the rights of citizenship in regard to health care and in regard to transportation and so forth, and less on a more litigious approach that we often take in a civil rights context.
Yeah. Well, I think that, as you know, was probably based on the earlier civil rights or the co-occurring civil rights movement from which this grew. So what do you see as the future issues in the little bit of time we have left? What do you see are the future issues for the ADA and for your work?
Well, we now have the first generation of kids with disabilities who have grown up not knowing a world without the Americans with Disabilities Act, not knowing a world without the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and they and their families are going to be have very high expectations. At the Burton Blatt Institute, for example, this summer we are running a summer camp called CHAT, Communication, Hope, and Assistive Technology, for young adults with very severe disabilities, and we want to work with them to introduce them to the new world of social media and technology.
Wow.
So that they can, they can be part of this new exciting trend. And all of our work, of course, is available online and freely published information, and I'm delighted if you or I tell your folks, your listeners, where they can get that information.
We'll certainly have a link to all of that on our website. And I want to thank you so much for sharing all of this very, very important information with us. As I said, in the 23 years since this has been passed, it's obviously had an enormous impact on our country and obviously on the world. So once again, I want to thank you for coming in, being on the phone and talking with us. My guest has been Dr. Peter Blank, and he is a university professor at Syracuse University, and he's also the chairman of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University, which advances the civil rights of people with disabilities around the world. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Blank.
Thank you very much.
So we are going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is HealthLink on Air. We'll be right back.